This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Bring us another round of discussions on geopolitics, focusing attention on the relationships between China as well as South Africa. We decided to focus on this particular two countries because of some of the developments we saw over the past weeks in terms of the Americans flexing their muscle, feeling some kind of a disquiet with the relations between South Africa and China, particularly following those military drills. But they mention a whole lot of things in terms of also economic relations that South Africa has with China. But part of the main reason why we're having this kind of discussion as well, it's that China has a special place in the governing party, the African National Congress. And you look at China's trajectory in terms of economic growth, in terms of their influence as a superpower in the world. And you look at how South Africa is declining to an extent where some people like Admistra, for instance, that are saying we are at a guara-guara state. We are right in the middle of a failed state as we speak. And you ask yourself questions in terms of if South Africa is so close to China, and we know about missions and missions, people that are always in China and so on, and we know this closer relationship, and you say, how do we have China progressing so much and we have our country declining so much in the context of the bilateral relations that we have, and also extending it to the relationship with BRICS, and also the fact that the Chinese people in South Africa have been given special status in terms of the BEE status. You know, it caused a whole lot of controversy. We spoke to Minister of International Relations some time back, Dr. Naledi Pandor, and obviously given, you know, she gave context in terms of why the Chinese people in South Africa are given that BEE status. So we just thought that we will unpack all these developments. So to help us, hopefully at a later stage, we'll be also joined by Professor John Gong, who is a professor of economics at the University of International Business and Economics. But in the meantime, he's in Beijing. But in the meantime, it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. David Munyai, who is the Associate Professor of Political Science and International Relations and Director for the Center for Africa-China Studies. Dr. David, good morning to you. Welcome to Power Talk.
Good morning to you and to all listeners.
Brother, I want us to start with the transition that the Chinese made, because one thing that I want to understand as well is this model of development, because South Africa keeps talking about, especially the current Cyril Ramaphosa administration, talking about building a capable and development state. But I want also to start off with China in terms of their transition from a communist state to a socialist state. So for me, the question is, does it really make a difference in terms of having to transform your policy from being a communist state to a socialist state? What is the difference there?
I think to just put it simply is that since 1949, the Chinese Communist Party under Chairman Mao had this strong socialist after the revolution in which no private sector, strictly the state running almost everything. With his death in 1976 and the opening of the Chinese economy in 1978 under Deng, then they much gravitated to a mixed economy, continue with socialism, but with a much more investments from international community, including the Chinese economy itself, private sector, and state-led economy, which is something similar that the ANC in the early days in 1990s, if you remember, ready to govern, that South Africa will pursue a mixed economy where you allow your state enterprises and at the same time encouraging small businesses and ensure that the economy carries both a capitalistic and a socialist kind of a policy.
Mm. Interesting, because there was a time in that period where you mentioned the document Ready to Govern. There was a time when there was an internal debate within the African National Congress, but it also spilled outside in terms of principles, for instance, or policies like nationalization and stuff. So, and it was a bit of a worry, you know, particularly to the private sector when this policy of nationalization, it was mentioned, and they were talking about issues like the mines and so on and so forth. So in terms of the approach that was taken by China, did they at all consider the issue of nationalization? I'm glad that you mentioned the fact that they had to rope in the private sector and find a way of involving them in drawing the economy. But was this issue of nationalization ever a factor in the Chinese lexicon?
Yeah, there are quite a number of similarities, but I think China also demonstrated a very unique in the sense that the economy since 1949 has always been state-led, and therefore there are these huge SOEs in China. The only difference is that there is the growth of your private sector in bringing the MNCs, I mean, your multinational companies, investing in China, as well as small business that is growing so fast. I mean, we have seen the rise of giants such as your Huawei that are private, and then in so many thousands of companies that, I mean, sprung out of that policy. However, the Chinese did not waste time as we do. We spend a lot of time talking and developing policies that accumulate dust. We are very bad at implementation. So the issue of nationalization is not a huge issue in China. It's that the state enterprise companies are being strengthened, managed efficiently, cutting inefficiencies, cutting corruption, and also run professionally. So the hire and fire officials without any regard of who is running. So that model has been so successful. It has been able to ensure that the state goes in areas in the zones where the private sector cannot go. In our case, I mean, areas that are poor in Limpopo, KwaZulu-Natal, I mean, Eastern Cape, where there's no private sector. So the state leads by building infrastructure, major roads, internet, building schools, and ensure that that development will take place at a later stage. And then you see the private sector also growing in those areas. So there's that interplay between the state and private sector. They work together hand in hand.
You know, I must say to the power listeners that, I mean, quite obviously we extended an invitation to the African National Congress, particularly the International Relations, the committee chairperson, because it's an important discussion in terms of this deep relations between, you know, the ANC and the Communist Party of China. And obviously, even at the government level, the relations between South African government and the Chinese government. And to say, why is this Chinese machinery, government machinery or state machinery, operating at an optimum? And whereas in the country, it's something totally different. You mentioned something, Dr. Munyai, that we keep talking about. And I mean, it is exhausting. It is frustrating. And I think even yourself, you're saying it for the 100th time to say policies are there, decisions are taken at the high level, but when coming to the implementation and execution, that's where we fail. And I mean, it is quite frustrating, even to an extent that at the State of the Nation address last year, the president appointed Mr. Nkosi, you know, as somebody who must be responsible for dealing with bureaucracy within government. But I'm just saying, from what you are saying, that the difference with the Chinese is because when they take decisions, then there are timelines, there's an execution plan, and things are done. In South Africa, what needs to be done, really? Because we are tired of this question of saying, plans are there, policies are there, but they are not being implemented. What needs to be done differently?
I think we have a very simple way to resolve this crisis. It's just to implement policies and take tough decisions in terms of the SOEs, ensure that we hire people with skills on a non-partisan basis, and sign contracts with these people that they have certain KPIs that they need to achieve. Failure doing so, they'll be fired. It's as simple as that. And become tough on issues of reckless use of resources, corruption, and lock up people using due process. We have a very liberal democracy and due process in the courts, and ensure that there's no corruption, zero tolerance on those issues. And we have to declare corruption as a crime against humanity in this country. That when you steal sandwich for kids going to crash, it's a crime against humanity. And we have to be tough and not looking at the background, whoever has done it. And this issue of protecting people has to come to an end. I think it will be good for the ANC as a party, it will be good for the country, and ensure that people have confidence in the system, that those who learn skills are going to be applied, and ensure that leadership has a clear understanding of what they're leading in the field they're leading. You cannot take people with no skills running multi-billion enterprises. So I think there are a number of things that needs to be done, and ensure that we don't push out the private sector. The private sector should play the role that it is playing to ensure that we close the gap between the poor and the rich in this country. So the danger we have is that we have only few people who are the winners all the time, whether it's in education, in health, in all spheres of life, while others are being pushed out of the system. And we cannot rely on social grants. Social grants are not supposed to be term and feature. People need to get into a social grant system, but graduate out of it. I think that's what is needed, in my view.
Well, comparison or what can you call it? Analysis, doing a comparison between South Africa and China and what needs to be done, considering that China's trajectory of growth is quite impressive, whereas ours, it's not impressive at all. Helping us unpack this situation is Dr. David Munyai, Associate Professor of Political Science and International Relations and Director for the Center of Africa-China Studies. We'll be back with you after this.
9 a.m. to noon. This is Power Talk on Power 98.7.
All right, 23 minutes after the hour 10. Prof, you spoke about the decisiveness of the Chinese government when coming to issues of incompetence. This morning I was watching an interview of Dr. Malkapur Mkhoba, and he says lack of quality leadership, it's a pandemic. It's another pandemic in this country. He mentioned that because we are doing a comparison analysis of China and South Africa. At times, government, we can understand that there are some constraints, well, call them self-created constraints, because they're in a tripartite alliance with the South African Communist Party, which is not a problem in terms of their China relations and Russia relations, but they have also an alliance with the unions. And the unions, from time to time, obviously, they have to push back against whatever government does if they feel that it is not to the interest of their members. Look at the chaos that is caused by the Hawi strikes, to an extent that there are people dead, patients dead And according to the Minister of Health, Dr. Joe Patla, he's saying four or even more people that died, it's directly linked to this particular strike. And there won't be any consequence management. So the fact that there are unions involved in this tripartite alliance with the governing party, is that a reason why government cannot move with speed in terms of decision-making and being decisive about issues of national importance as compared to what has been done by the Chinese government?
I think it's a quite controversial issue and sensitive. However, there are a number of things that need to be said. One is that the alliance is not really well-defined in terms of what are the red lines. I think the lack of those red lines, I mean, where trade union will say the government should not do certain things and discussions, that issues that affect their workers, they have a right to demonstrate, they have a right to protect workers, but that should not be done at the expense of patients. I think it's a national security issue. Where education is the same issue. If we can define that as a national security, no teacher should leave students toying while a student is supposed to write exams. I mean, that in itself, it poses a national security. So, I mean, those clear issues need to be debated within the alliance and restructure the relationship where that both the government and trade unions will fully understand that certain issues, certain practice and behavior constitute a serious threat to the agenda of national democratic revolution. But as it stands, it appears that things are not clearly defined, and we end up seeing all these things, lack of order, a lack of inspectors for teachers, and teachers just do whatever they want. I have respect. I'm a teacher myself, so I have respect for teachers and their rights. But I think the right of our children to be educated should come above our own.
Okay. Makashu Legana is on the line. He's a political activist and a social organizer. He wants to weigh in into the discussion. Makashu, good morning. You're welcome.
Good morning, Brio, and good morning to the prof. I just want to weigh in on this conversation, and especially on the point around the capable leaders or the capable people that needs to be appointed, whether it's in government departments or the state-owned entities. But the other aspect, Murillo, that I just feel in South Africa we don't talk enough about, it's our own culture. The culture that suggests in a way that we think about the now. So there's no long-term view of what our actions contribute to us. Sometimes people, when they are appointed, they feel that maybe it's their time to eat, you know, and they don't realize that actually what they are eating, they are eating the inheritance of the next generation. Mm. And this thing is what has brought us to this, I think the prof referred to, or it's yourself, referred to the Guaraguara state, where we are getting, or we are edging closer to a failed state, you know, because those that are appointed in these state-owned entities in government departments, their culture is such that it's in a way selfish, you know, in that you don't think about other people that stands to benefit from your efforts as a state employee. But another last point, Rio and Prof, is that I think there's a culture in South Africa of living beyond our means, which creates a fertile ground for public officials and politicians alike to be easily corruptible. because in order to sustain the kind of lifestyle that many have chosen to live, you need to be able to almost steal or have someone funding that lifestyle. And this is something that, if you contrast it to the impact of culture in driving development, and I would like the prof to maybe reflect on the impact of culture in driving development and the kind of culture that exists in South Africa, both from a political side, but in our way of living. Thanks very much, Greg.
Thank you so much. I think that's a great point that we will reflect on after the news headlines. Prof Munyai, the issue of culture, because we have developed this culture of crass materialism. We live beyond our means. Just even recently at the airport, Minister of Home Affairs, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi, was interviewed by my colleague Thabiso Kotane just 2 days back. They've arrested an official in immigration, basically because he was stamping passports. I mean, you know, basically that is treasonous. You're putting a national security at risk. And how they detected it? It's because of his lifestyle. They did a lifestyle audit and they started monitoring him until he was nabbed 2 days ago. So we will explore that. The issue of culture is raised by Makashilo Ghana when we return from the 10:30 news headlines with Nkosikhona Malingamnisi.
Getting you what you need to know. Power Talk. Weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Power 98.7.
All right, 25 minutes before the hour 11 o'clock, we continue our conversation with Professor David Munyai, Associate Professor of Political Science and International Relations and Director for the Center for Africa China Studies at Wits University. Prof, the issue of culture, maybe we should also, you know, indicate that you look at the number of political parties that are registered with the IEC. Okay, some, they don't meet the threshold, but we've got hundreds and hundreds of political parties that are contesting elections. Because it seems as if people see politics as an easy way to live lavish lifestyles and so on because of the materialism that we see. Let's unpack what Makashule Ghana has asked about this culture of exorbitant lifestyles that we see lived out by people in political power and, of course, people in the bureaucracy of government.
This is a serious crisis that we have. And culture takes time to change. But I think let's just see what went wrong first and how to fix it going forward. I think what went wrong is it's centuries of colonial and apartheid system that entrenched a culture of violence, selfishness, brutal management of the system for the few. It used to be racial. Post 94, I think there are certain elements in the manner in which we struggled and brought independence and at a political level, then making the country ungovernable and things like that. What it literally means is that we declared war against the state during the apartheid, but post 94, there was never any ceasefire. We continue with that sense in our community, everywhere else, that if you are angry, you have to burn a building, you have to destroy something that belongs to the community. There's that anger. And while the elites, on the other hand, they just get a chance of enriching themselves at the expense, and it's not all elites, those who were corrupt, that a lot of people were doing well, however, they're not given opportunity to continue achieving great things that the country is registering. So that culture continues. There is a need to handle it. Not only ANC, but all political parties and civil society. There is a need to discuss and see other nations, not just China. Look in Paris as we speak, massive demonstrations in France. millions of people on the streets. It was violent at times, but we don't hear issue of destruction of property and things like that. And we look at China in terms of zero tolerance on corruption. Senior officials are locked up if they don't go in line of the party in terms of its strategic objectives and national development agenda that is clearly defined. I think we also need to develop our own norms and values as Africans, but learn and draw lessons from China and other societies, how best to manage a culture of improving the lives of our people. I think that's the only thing that we need to do. How do we improve the lives of our people? How do we ensure that the mining, land, education, science and technology, all these issues benefit everyone, not just few tiny black elite and white population. So I think we need to change the structure of the economy. We need to do something. I think it's within us. I think if you look at the policies, excellent policies are out there. It's just a question of acting on them and going beyond the governing party, bringing everyone on board in achieving these ideas.
Yeah. Prof Munya, you mentioned the decisiveness of the Chinese when dealing with, including high-ranking officials of China when coming to issues of corruption, that they're very decisive. They're locked, they're arrested, they're prosecuted, they're locked up. But I even heard somewhere where they're saying, you know, even go to an extent of facing a firing squad. Is that still happening for corruption in particular?
There is death penalty in China, and at some point, I mean, if a senior, whether it's a minister or anyone, there was a minister, I think, of transport that was locked. If you steal above a million, it used to be a death penalty. I mean, we don't follow death penalty in this country. However, I think we can find appropriate tough measurements of ensuring that no one will try to steal resources of ordinary people.
Yeah. You know, during the CODESA elections that collapsed and they were reconvened as multi-party talks in forming a new republic that emerged in 1994, one of the biggest contentious issues was on the state architecture. What form of state should we have in this country? Whether we should have a unitary state or a federal state. If you recall, Prof Munyai, the likes of IFP, for instance, and other leaders from the TBVC states, because Bantu had already, you know, did a coup d'etat there in Transkei, but Ciskei under Upacozo, Mangope Putatswana, and others, and championed by IFP leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi, including other Afrikaners like Constant Viljoen and the Conservative Party. They wanted a federal state because they were talking about self-determination, whereas the ANC were driving for a unitary state. And it was one of the compromises that, you know, that had to be done that saw the IFP as well as the Freedom Front Plus under Constant Viljoen coming into the negotiations and the elections. The unitary state. The Chinese government has used this central government approach to marshal the limited resources, you know, in order to build a thriving China. Here in South Africa, we fought so hard. I mean, a lot of people died in that conflict of these issues of federal state or unitary state and so on, particularly the conflict between the ANC and the IFP that was sponsored then by the National Party. Well, some rogue elements of the National Party. But the fact that the Chinese government used this central government architecture to work so hard, why isn't the ANC using this central government just like their Chinese counterparts, considering that for so many years, except later on, they only lost the Western Cape province, but for many years, they've governed the entire country. But look, where we are, What are the lessons to be learned there? Prof. Munyai, are you there with us? Okay. I think, don't do me so, we might have lost Professor David Munyai. We know the issue of load shedding. Maybe in the meantime, let me take Xoli in MLO. We'll come back to that question of unitary state or central government versus federal government. Okay, let me just check. Prof. Munyai, are you back with us?
Yes, I am.
All right. Did you get my question?
Yes, I did. Right. I think the point that I was trying to make was that since 1994, we have been saying that the ANC must move speedily to use its majority in parliament for its third majority in terms of changing the constitution. The constitution, as beautiful as it is not cast in stone. With third majority, you can change the constitution in key areas. A number of issues that we need to do. One, the 1910 agreement of having the judiciary in Bloemfontein, parliament in Cape Town, and the political capital in Pretoria. I mean, you can consolidate that. You bring parliament to Pretoria, you bring judiciary in one place to cut resources. I mean, there has been talk forever. However, it doesn't appear that's going to happen anytime soon. It's something that can be done tomorrow. Land, I think negotiations need to reach a point of implementing and ensure that it is done fairly and in the right way. And therefore, I think a number of issues that need to be resolved to use the law and to do it in a way, also learning from other countries, including China, of efficiently moving on issues of good governance and doing it properly, run with the private sector. But when it comes to the role of the state in education, prioritize certain areas. Apartheid deprived former Bantu states you are talking about. Why not turn it upside down? I mean, prioritize those areas. Ensure that the state does something to improve the lives of those in poor regions to avoid massive movement of people from poor areas coming into urban areas. So these you require to have a strong transmit, taking off all the heavy trucks that are moving chemicals on our roads and becoming dangerous on back to the rail. It's something that can be done. It's not something beyond the president and the ministers. It can be fixed. So I think the decisiveness needs to start right there if we are to move forward.
Oli, MLO, good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning, Brother Mario and the brother professors. Are you there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, man. You see, brother, the difference here is we want to compare ourselves with China. China is very much different from us. One, China uses what you call Chinese philosophies and ideologies. And we don't do that. You know, we copy from the West in particular. Our democracy is a United States version what we have here. So we are going to fail for that reason. Not until we acknowledge people like Steve Biko as philosophers, people like Robert Sobukwe and all of them, and take the ideology that they championed, that to practice at home, do away with coconuts, do away with spinouts, because those are people who are pulling us back. Do away with a stupid analyst who can't analyze because they are suffering from a disease that I call mental slavery. You see, when you suffer from mental slavery, you can't analyze. Hence, we've been having this analyst from 94, and they've been analyzing nonsense. Hence, we're in this predicament as a country. Not until we embark on a journey as a country to emancipate ourselves from mental slavery using our own tools as Africans, not foreign tools, not even Chinese. Chinese use their own thing. Let us use our own thing here in our country to clean up our country so that we can see that one thing that makes us to suffer is white monopoly capital, and attack it, dismantle it, destroy it, and create a country that will benefit all the people, particularly Africans, because they are the worst of them all. Thank you very much, my brother.
Thank you very much. Koli in Emelo there, got it off your chest. Let's look at the issue of manufacturing. And earlier on, I brought in the issue of unions that are in alliance with the governing African National Congress Party. There was a massive outcry about what we call cheap Chinese imports. And even the unions were accused that, particularly COSATU unions, some over a decade ago, when they were convening their conferences, the merchandise that they were using, it was imported from China. And there was if you look at our manufacturing industry, it's been decimated. China has industrialized, massively industrialized. And South Africa as a trade partner, and not just a trade partner, but a partner with the Chinese government, to an extent that we even afforded the Chinese in South Africa BEE status. People are saying cheap Chinese imports have killed our manufacturing industry. It has been said over a decade ago, and we are talking about creating new industries and so on and so forth. But nothing, it's just been said, people are still importing cheap Chinese goods. What needs to be done there? Because manufacturing used to employ so many people in this country. You look at the firms, for instance, in the former TBVC states, you look at industrial sites in Harankou, Ababelech, Soweto, wherever you can go, they're all closing down. So what needs to be done there? Is South African government scared that if they can start reindustrializing and cutting, importing all these cheap things, they might sour their relations? Or is there something that we don't know, Prof. Munyak?
It's... I don't know if you remember that during COVID, the president announced the launch of a company that is going from Middle East, I think, going to manufacture gadgets, cell phones in Durban, I think. It is closed now.
Yeah.
And if there's anything that we are buying more than anything, it's technological gadgets. But we don't manufacture them here. We have all the minerals, we have all what is required, skills and everything else. I think we need to ask that main question. Why is it that we can? With the load shedding, we are not manufacturing solar panels in this country. With such a huge demand for solar panels. I think those questions need to be asked. How then do we do, which parts of our economy do we close and ensure that we protect, we don't open endlessly to not just China, to outsiders, and ensure that we develop telecoms. I mean, China itself, when they opened up in 1978, they closed a number of areas. Telecom was one major area they closed up. Foreign companies coming in those state-led. So there are a number of things that are required. We just have to be very serious in the trade deals that we sign, whether it's AGOA or with China or with EU, and ensure that we protect local industry. Textile, I think, one major area that was destroyed, and you said it rightly. So we have to think quite seriously, and we cannot work on our own. We have to work at the regional level with 59, 60 million people. I mean, at the global level, it's a small and insignificant number population-wise as a market. However, if we operate within SADC, we're talking about 200, almost 300 million people. And the continental level with the free trade area, we're talking of 1.2, 1.3 billion people. That gives us more power in the negotiations we can enter with the Chinese, with Americans and the Europeans. As it stands, we tend to to close up in our small colonial unity states while we don't know what DRC is doing, Zambia, South Africa, and Zimbabwe. So there is a need for a unity close certain core areas where we have capacity and knowledge and develop. That's what all other countries are doing. So we are not doing that.
Yeah, indeed. Let's take a quick break. When we return, I see you, Winnie, in Runbeck, Godwin in Tshwane.
Murio Sanyane on Power 98.7.
Of course, the Knox man standing in for the Queen of Hearts, Lerato Mbele. Let's go to Winnie in Runbeck. Winnie, good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you, Thabiso?
Murio, I'm good. Yeah.
Sorry,
it's all right. It's all right.
I just wanted to participate in a conversation. I'm just thinking that with us South Africans, what we're lacking now is self-respect and self-reliance. We rely too much on others. I think if we can go back and look at the way China and the Chinese are doing things, you know, they are highly disciplined, a nation. They are self-leaders. You know, they lead themselves. They don't expect, you know, handout or to be led by unscrutable people and corrupt people.
Mm.
If we can go back, you know, to our Ubuntu, I think that will, you know, that will we'll be able to do business, you know, ethically. We will do, you know, everything ethically if we can just go back to our Ubuntu and stop relying on other people. But we need to have self leadership and be disciplined. I think that is the way to go.
We need run back. Now we are talking. Godwin Tshwane, welcome. Godwin Tshwane? Okay.
Good morning, Murio.
Yes, sir. Proceed.
Yes, just a quick one. I think the problem we have is for us to actually transition like China, we need to remove politics in our technology and every other thing, and we need to remove nepotism and favoritism and zero tolerance. That's all we need.
Okay, Godwin Tshwane there. George Makanda, your comment this morning.
Khurotmani, I think we have a serious problem. There's no political will. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we're the only country in the world where you get communists sleeping with capitalists and labor in the same bed.
It's mere manure.
Yes. We are very sad because we don't even have the grasp of concepts like patriotism. Yeah. I was watching a clip of a child, a Chinese child. Unfortunately, you are comparing us with China. It's an unfair comparison, but it's a fair one at the same time. This boy, by about 2-3, he was crying. When the national anthem started to play, he stopped. He stood up, he saluted, and he sang. We still have people who are wearing all blacks jerseys, as an example, saying they are against the Springboks. We don't have the semblance of or the understanding, grasping what patriotism is. Not having political will, our politicians are signing us off. I mean, an example of COP26. Why do you sign COP26, although we've got hundreds of years of coal underneath our feet, and then you don't have a substitute?
Yeah.
Things like that. So we still, and to an extent, to their defense, although it's unfair, it's still early. We still have less than 30 years of this very wrong concept called democracy. It's wrong because you go all over the world, the custodians of democracy don't have multi-parties. As in South Africa, we've got multi-parties. So we are a very, very...
Okay, Georgie,
I
got you.
I have a lot to say.
I know. Next time. Thank you very much. Prof. Munyai, in a minute, we have taken over the chairmanship of BRICS. What should South Africa prioritize in this... geopolitic arena called BRICS?
I think firstly, it's going to be quite a tough situation. The BRICS summit this year is going to be different from others because of the changing geopolitics and tension between US, Russia and China. I think that is putting pressure on us. However, I think South Africa should and must continue applying its independent foreign policy, ensure that it converge with BRIC countries on issues of mutual benefit. At the same time, cultivate the relationship with Western countries where we have an advantage and work closely with them. But it's going to be a tough, so much is going to take place. BRICS might expand, but South Africa should not go it alone. It is to bring in more of the African continent and ensure that, the continent is a priority, not in the negative sense, in geopolitics manner, as the case right now. But benefit in terms of kind of trade, avoid dumping of weapons on the continent, and ensuring that we continue with infrastructure development, bringing all these important players from outside the world.
Professor David Munyai is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Relations and Director for the Center for Africa-China Studies at Wits University. We thank you, sir, for your great insights.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.